Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Dan Aronson broadcasting on the mighty banks of the Willamette River in Portland, Oregon, coming to you live and with my special co-host this evening. Normally, as most of you know, Debbie Lynn Molyneux takes good care of me, and I've got her, possibly even her mentor, I don't know. We might have to ask her, but I've got Janine Loudon, very lucky and pleased to have Janine Loudon riding shotgun with me tonight. How are you doing, Janine?
I'm doing great, and it's not Oregon, it's Oregon.
You know, I just resigned myself that's going to be your, I'm going to be your and Debbie Lynn's little punching bag for that for the rest of my life. I do try at times, I go, wait, say it right, but then I keep going, no, it's Oregon, that's how it's spelled, that's how I was taught it when I was growing up in school and all the way through college, so. It's going to take a little time for me to break my 50-year-old habit of saying Oregon. Sorry.
That's all right. We have to give you a little bit of grief, especially since you live in Portlandia, and you know how politically correct Portlandia is.
Absolutely. Yeah. People here are not. You don't get a lot of guff because I don't know. People, it just doesn't seem like they have time to give you guff. They've got other things to do, like craft brew, the world's greatest microbrews. And
yes.
Sip on endless cups of coffee and dodge raindrops.
Precisely.
I think that's about it. But tonight we have what I believe is an interesting topic. Tonight we're going to be talking about transpartisan economics. Can we make it happen? So just by way of setting it up, I wanted to talk about my neighborhood back in Atlanta. So just to give you a little bit of background on me, I spent 35 years growing up in the suburbs of Chicago. I then moved my family down to Marietta, Georgia, where I bought a house and spent 15 years there. I still own that house there because, like everybody in Marietta, I'm upside down in it. But what I do is I've rented it out to a few of my son's friends, and I moved out here to the wonders of Portland, Oregon, and the great Northwest, and I'm enjoying life greatly, even if I don't know how to properly pronounce the name of the state. But I want to talk to y'all specifically about and see even just talking about it, Janine. I just yawled. I don't know if you got that because I
did.
People from Chicago don't normally yawl, but I'm going to talk about my 15-year stint in Atlanta. And of course, as most of you know, Georgia as a whole tends to be pretty red. And you have Atlanta and the certain areas within Atlanta, like most big states, where you'll have your bastions of blue. And but for the most part, the folks I grew up or were living around, I should say, they were fairly conservative. Some could quote you Rush Limbaugh chapter and verse. And God bless them. After a while, you just learn to. I don't know, either give up or you just keep trying and you just be patient and you do all that good transpartisan stuff, right? But then there were people like my wife and other people who were transplanted because, of course, Atlanta is a very transient town. And so you get a lot of people that move in from all over the country, a lot of New York, a lot of people from New York. Long Island, for some reason specifically, was in a vastly represented in our neighborhood, all over the Midwest and another more typically blue places. So you have this nice clash now of political ideals. And, anytime, a beer has been drank or, you're sitting around and some news of the day pops up, then, the you're crazy versus the you're crazy conversations typically tend to ensue, which I think gives you, or gave me at least, a ringside seat for what is, unfortunately, a microcosm for what our country has become and how we engage in political conversation. However, I started to notice something very interesting, and that was whenever they were talking about national issues, that's when these huge arguments would ensue. But when people got together and started talking about the local schools and how they were seeing them improve, or talk about first responders, or talk about waste removal services, or sewer services, water services, or electric service, all those local things, all of a sudden, everybody was on the same side. They, of course, all wanted the best schools. They, of course, all wanted the best public services, utilities, first responders. Everybody wants that in their neighborhood. And I thought, man, there's transpartisanship right there. And I thought, maybe you guys could help me figure out how we can take that kind of that kind of attitude on the local level, where everybody comes together because everybody's got the same stake in the game. And how do we push that up to the national level? How do we make that a national transpartisan? Do we make politics in this country nationally transpartisan? So if you'd like to help me figure that out, you can either type in the chat room if you're online, and if you're not and you'd like to actually speak to us, please call in at 646-929-2495 and press 1, and we'll put you into the host queue and we'll get you on the air, and you can help us figure this out. And speaking of which, I think Janine had some really good perspective on it. I'd like her to share that with us, if you don't mind.
Well, I think what you're talking to is when I agreed to do this show with you today and to be your co-pilot, I was speaking to the fact that transpartisan for me was a relief, and it was refuge from the term bipartisan. Bipartisan obviously has a very technical meaning, but it's become one of those code words, you know? And as a code word, it, regardless of its real meaning, the meaning it has now is actually kind of pointing to the fact that it's so fashionable to be partisan that bipartisan is pretending to get along. I mean, that's what it means to me now. And so what I like about transpartisan is it sort of lifts us out of the paradigm, red, blue, Democrat, Republican, especially since very few people I know are either one, and, you know, brings us back to what is the issue at hand, and can we discuss it like neighbors, or can we discuss it as, you know, the coffee party was based on, let's sit down, let's have a cup of coffee, let's talk about this, and let's be civil. And I bet we'll together come up with something better than anything we've heard. And so for me, it's an indicator, it is a sign of the times that we actually have to work so hard to declare ourselves free of talking points, you know, that Pavlovian response partisanship that's triggered by talking points and code words. And, I mean, it's just the nasty business that politics has become.
Well, so I have a couple of follow-up questions I'd like to get to with you, but I also see that if I don't miss my guess, that Mr. Jack is on the phone. So I wanted to bring Jack right in here. Is that you, isn't it, Mr. Jack?
Yeah, this is Jack Golding.
How are you, sir?
Fine.
Thank you for joining us tonight.
What I want to do is say that my solution to this problem is to have nonpartisan primaries, like there was in California. I lived in California for 39 years, and around the time Arnold Schwarzenegger was running for governor, there was a nonpartisan primary. There would have been about 100 people competing in that primary, and it was Schwarzenegger won, of course. Actually, I think I voted for him. It was against Gray Davis. And I think that's a solution to that. I'm absolutely against a two-party system.
It's interesting you say that, because that was going to be my question for Janine when she talked about bipartisanship. So Two things popped into my head.
Let me continue.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jack.
Yeah. Absolutely anti-partisanship. And back in around 85 or 86, there's a guy from Kansas, so of all places, where I live right now, who called me un-American because I was against the two-party system.
I take it that was a compliment.
It's a compliment to me.
Right. That's what I mean. He called you an American, right?
Un-American.
Oh, he called you un-American. Oh, no.
Un-American, yeah.
No, I think he had it wrong.
Un-American for being against the two-party system.
Did he give you a reason why?
I can't remember that far back. It was 85, 86, that was around the time the Bears won their first...
first and only.
First and only, yeah. Chicago Bears won their first and only...
Super Bowl.
Pennant.
Yep, I was there. Were you doing the Super Bowl shuffle, Jack?
I can't remember. But I did. I did go wore a Bears T-shirt or something like that when I did.
Well, we won't tell those Chiefs fans then.
What?
I said we won't tell the Chiefs fans.
Well, they won it against who they win it against? I think the Patriots.
Yep, New England.
Yeah. By 30 some odd points.
Widest margin ever at the time, yep.
46-13 or something like that. Yeah.
And it was close for about a quarter, and then the Bears pulled away.
I think the Patriots won the first 3 points, and then the bingo.
Yeah. That was about
it. The only football I follow, you know, involves a World Cup and FIFA, and so I don't even know who you're talking about. But hey,
well, we'll forgive you.
You're my friend, Janine.
Yes, I am. So I think Dan wants to talk about the implication of bipartisan, and you've already really said that, you know. You don't even think it should be a two-party system and that we should have open primaries. And so you probably agree with me that bipartisan is actually, in terms of language, really kind of locks the gate and keeps other parties out of the mainstream conversation. You know, so just the fact that it's bipartisan, it's not even multipartisan or, you know, ubiquitously unpartisan or, you know what I mean? Think of some grandiose term. But bipartisan really says there's R's, there's D's, and all the rest of you are slackers. And I agree with you, Jack, and I'm suspicious that Dan feels this way, too, that's an inherent problem in our political process today.
Oh. Yeah, well, no, certainly, Janine, you're right, and you know me to be a big advocate of third parties and whatnot. I guess it depends on your point of reference. I mean, if you want to be sure that there isn't a viable third party, okay, that's fine. We can look at the mechanics of our government that makes sure that ensures that is, you know, that we'll never have a viable third party until there's some serious reconstructing of our political institutions. But within the context of the fact that there are only two parties, then I was just wondering why bipartisan meant, why didn't that mean that for once, you know, and the angels, you know, the chorus of angels sings, they are actually agreement.
Well, I think that's the irony here is that, we say bipartisan when we're supposedly meaning transpartisan. You know, so I really believe that word is very loaded. And it really closes the door to participation by others. And, I mean, for example, the presidential debates in the end, you know, Romney and Obama, it was bipartisan. Like, what the heck? There were several worthy and qualified, you know, meaning having met the criteria, candidates out there. And even if there's no hope in heck that those people will win an election, the contribution is not just in the winning. The contribution is in the participation, in the conversation, in the ideas that have to be discussed. You know, and economics, this whole notion of transpartisan economics is really key here, because you're only going to get two well-honed platform built, talking point, underwritten, you know, there you are. You're locked in. You're locked in before anyone even opens their mouth. And then it just becomes this weird conversation of like tennis, hitting the talking point words back and forth at each other. And it's like, well, what? And it's not even Wimbledon where anybody's going to really crash and burn, you know. It's like, so I'm with you and Jack, Dan, that this whole, I never say bipartisan, because I think it's like,
okay.
You know, it's like we let human beings and women in this club. You know, it's like, what do you mean bipartisan?
Okay. Yet something else, Jack?
Okay, let me say one last thing. I have an idea of the third party. Would take the philosophies, meld the philosophies of the two Roosevelts, maybe with a little bit of Reagan thrown in. Because Reagan, whether you like it or not, he is a fighter. So were the two Roosevelts.
I like it. I like the combination. I agree. There's a lot of goodness in all three of those guys.
You've got to find people of courage who are willing to work with guys like me to form such an organization, such an entity.
Go ahead, Jack.
Would you mind if I contact you offline? I think I have one for you.
Offline. Okay.
Email
me. I think I know my email address. Just email me on my blog at jackgolding12@gmail.com.
All right, Jack, you got it.
Okay, I just want to get. Okay, bye. Okay, I'll listen to her.
All right.
I won't share the rest.
Thanks, Jack. Appreciate your call as always. So, yeah, very, very interesting. How do we get rid of political parties altogether? I think that's the end game, right, that Jack's going for. Which, I don't know that that's necessarily a bad idea, but, I mean, if you can only have two, then probably we should do away with them if we can't have 200. But, you know, something you hit on earlier, though, Janine, is that, you know, we were talking about the transpartisan movement and how it comes out much more naturally at the local level. Well, at the local level, you usually have tons of parties, right? I know in the state of Oregon,
yes.
Every time I go to one of these street fairs, there seems to be 4, 5, 6, 7 active parties. And at the in the local levels, and at this county level, sometimes even more.
That's right. That's right. There's a gazillion political parties in Oregon. And I don't know other states as well, so I can't speak for them. It's not that I think we're different. It's just that I don't really know. And I think it's because there are some very strong philosophical tenets associated with each one of them. And I don't see any great melting pot having the answer. But ultimately, what the real question is, whether there's two parties or 10, how do you get them to work together in a political climate where basically once a politician gets into the state legislature or gets into the Congress of the United States, they start day one fundraising for their next election or fundraising to pay off their election. And so they're trying to say the right things and do the right things that'll bring attention of big donors to them. And it's, to me, that's the ultimate, you know, transpartisan in a way gives us the opportunity to have a conversation outside the political reality that right now most of our politicians are kind of sacked, kind of weighted down with an expectation of their funders that we, the voters, have no privy to.
I definitely see that on a lot of levels, state, local, at a bunch of different levels. And before I bring 804 into the conversation, I guess I would answer you by saying, if you could find a way to get them to actually do their jobs after the elections and actually legislate, having four or five or six parties where no one party is in the majority forces that conversation to happen. Now people have to have to work towards compromise, and they have to listen to everybody because you're wooing everybody's vote, because you need help now to get anything done.
And so you have to interact. I think that that's correct, and I really believe that.
No, and you know, and I hear a lot of people poo-poo the parliamentarian style governments that exist all over the rest of the world. But that is the one thing you have, is you have those five or six parties, each with their influence, and if you have enough in common with them, you know, like for instance, I mean, wouldn't it be great if somebody reached out and said, okay, here, Green Party, we're going to take your approach to the environment, you know, Constitutional Party, we're going to take this, and let's all get together and figure out how we melt this thing into a single thing, then maybe we challenge the big two. Well, I don't know.
I'm with you.
All right. 804. As Egberto Willis has said, who do I have the pleasure of speaking to?
Hi, good evening. My name is Hugh. I'm calling from Ashland, Virginia.
How are you, sir?
Wonderful. I just came across your show. I'm actually standing in my truth. I'm solution-oriented, and I have things that people aren't even thinking of that can be done if they'll just get more creative and utilize existing technologies. And if I can share my name in an interview that I did last month, on that interview, it will exactly confirm some of the things that I just said. Plus, there is a copy of a Wall Street front page article from back in 1983 that describes where I exposed a former federal government bureaucrat for fraud back then, who I believe was a CIA operative, and indirectly it eventually led to the resignation of Jim Wright from Speaker of the House in shame. And in that article, it beautifully describes just what the problems are in Washington, how lobbyists and special interests have totally corrupted the whole atmosphere there. It gives a description of a person who came to this lobbyist through me, who was looking to get retractable boat cleats put on boats as a safety item. The lobbyist said, we'll just pass a law and make it mandatory that from now on all manufacturers have to have retractable boat cleats. This kind of stuff goes on every single day in Washington. All these bills that they pass have all this pork and special interest added to it, that healthcare monstrosity. When you see somebody like Nancy Pelosi saying, let's just pass it and see what's in it after, what the heck is that? What has happened to this country? There's no accountability anymore, but there can be. And that, again, if you'll let me share my name so you can see this interview and the documents, and also online there's actually a copy of a letter from President Obama to me related to the economy, which I responded to and followed up numerous times without one word back from the administration. In my letter of response, I pointed out that I have no risk strategies that are actually a strategic intelligent enhancement to any business that will allow them at will to expand and diversify an unlimited degree and create jobs at the same time.
But right. Well, if you hang on 1 second, let's start with this. So let me get your name, and if you're going to give me the website, I'll type it into the chat room for our chat listeners.
All right. My name is Hugh, H-U-G-H. The last name is Trawlson. That's T like Tom. R-A-U-L-S-E-N like Nancy, and then for this interview after my name, just put the words Synchro, S-Y-N-C-H-R-O, Mystic, M-Y-S-T-I-C, Encounters. Hugh Trollson, Synchro, Mystic, Encounters, and you'll see the documents, the Wall Street Journal article, and some other items that can be read right from that website, as well as other links on that site. And
so that sounds fascinating. So I don't know if you had a chance to read what our show topic was for the evening, in talking about how can we use transpartisanship and move that from strictly being, at least easily being executed on a local level to the national level. I mean, you've hit on a lot of things that I agree with totally, if we can, I don't know if it's related to the topic at hand.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, what we have to do is realize that the corruption is rampant. It's not just in this country. This is a global agenda. There's a shadow government run by corporate elites behind the scenes. So these presidents, no matter what party you get, they're all corrupted by the time they get in there. They've agreed to things that behind the scenes that people aren't aware of.
So how do we break that cycle?
Through the transparency and truth. Now, the tools that you would use are in the second half of the interview that I just gave you the site for. My partner comes on and discusses some of the things that we're doing. We have an organization of affiliates of that has all kinds of video products. And this is where you get the local and working it all the way back to Washington. These technologies, why can't these elected officials do webinars weekly with all their constituents? They've had webinars with 250,000 people with no glitches, and let them interact with their constituents, and if they refuse to do the webinars, they're right out of there. If they do them, they can take majority agreements through the webinars on different things that they want to get done in Washington, and let's just get the transparency and get all these lobbyists the heck out of there. These lobbyists, if they can't represent their companies from their companies, there's no business for them to be in Washington. And these companies, if they can't police themselves, yes, then the government steps in. But this is where all the corruption is. It's because of all the money influence.
So I totally agree with you that technology is underutilized in our government. I work in the telecom sector. I work around the Ciscos and the Avayas and the people and the Microsofts, who are all doing the wonderful work in collaboration. And you're absolutely right. There's the technology exists. The technology probably exists if you want to take it to the end game for us. And I'll take it back and I'll just make a bolder statement. The technology definitely exists for this country to be able to move to a one-man, one-vote system, a true democracy.
Exactly. I agree completely. Here's my question,
all right? The sad truth is that there are 207 million eligible voters in this country at the last election, and 81 million of them didn't vote. Now, are they going to be more inclined to be involved if it's one person, one vote? And do you trust them?
Well, there again is where the truth and transparency comes to the forefront and everything, but I've put this out as a joke, but it could be very realistic. They should run the presidential campaigns like the Miss America contest and have both male and females do the bikinis in the part of the process.
Outside of the obvious humor that you would see there, I'm just picturing some of these guys that are not in great shape and aging. But other than
and
that,
Wiener is not allowed to run.
Okay. Well, I don't know.
The one thing I'll agree with on that is that it would make as much sense as probably 2/3 of the political ads I've listened to.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's absurd. You know, it's an absurd suggestion. But what we do is actually absurd. You know, so apples and oranges, or maybe this is oranges, the oranges.
I mean, if tuning into Snooki to see what her next move is, or Charlie Sheen, Why can't we do that with politics?
Lewis Black, I like Lewis Black's idea. He said, put a monkey in a drone with a parachute, set it on a random course, and then at some random time, the Bombay doors drop open, the monkey drops out, parachutes down, and the first person the monkey touches is the president. He said that would probably give as good a chance as us of having a great president as the way we do it now.
Yes. And it would be the monkey party. We could have the monkey party. So it is exactly this absurdity. It is exactly this comedy theater or, you know, tragedy theater or whatever that makes things like the sequester happen. That makes it possible for us to not be able to execute transpartisan economic conversation when lives are in the balance, when the future of the country is in the balance, where I actually don't know anything not in the balance when whomever is in charge does not understand money. And, you know, there can be a lovely conversation between people who come from different perspectives about the effective and responsible use of money. Believe me, because there's not one school of thought. But what we're doing now isn't that. You know, what we're doing now is jockeying for profit. You know, okay, you guys can have Medicare if I can still have record profits every quarter. You guys can have Social Security if I can still have all these government contracts. I mean, it's I don't know. And then they even start making book on it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's what derivatives are. They're making book on the quality of decisions, betting that they will all fail. So it's like we've gotten ourselves into that. What's the opposite of transpartisan, really? What is that? It's like non-thinking. It's not transpartisan thinking. It's non-thinking and totally reacting to influences that come at us from Lord knows where.
Oh, but we do know where. It comes from us. It comes from us from Washington D.C. with a specific purpose of keeping us off our guard, and it's amplified by the 1% media and paid for by the people who own Washington. I mean, it's the triumvirate, right? It's the tri-axis of evil, whatever you want to call it. You know, the media, politicians, and business, and it's made specifically to do it, and it.
Forget
usually boils down to that old bread and circus thing, right? Give them just enough bread and a little distraction, and then they won't bother us. We can just do what we want.
Churches are in that too.
I'm sorry? I missed that last part.
The churches are part of that control group too.
Oh, well. That's a whole other subject for a whole another show. But the church... I believe the church is in conflict with and in constant fighting with politics. But that goes back to the fact that they both have the exact same goals, right? You know, and when I say church, I mean most organized religions. I don't want to say all, but most organized religions have a goal of a very few people controlling a much larger group of people and their resources.
Exactly.
Kind of sounds like all the other players in the game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's
actually to get the masses engaged because they're so apathetic, and that's pathetic. But you might point out to people that election day is not just certain days, but every single day you buy a product, you're actually casting a vote for the manufacturer of that product. So if you're going to buy lead-based painted toys out of China through Walmart, your kids don't have a choice, but you do. You can choose American or choose another country with a good quality product.
No, I totally agree. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I remember in the run-up to this last election, some enterprising young lady created at least the prototype of a Koch Brothers app. And it's like if you were going to the store and you wanted to know if the Koch Brothers had any ownership interest in any products that were on the shelf and you just didn't want to buy them, she was going to make an app for that. Strange. Never, ever got to market.
Well, you know, I actually do that when I go shopping, but I have to go to a website and the website tells me, you know, but an app would be brilliant. I think that would be great. the dealer really needs to give it away.
I don't mean to be a conspiracy theorist, but I mean, again, the app was out. It was socialized. She had a beta of it, and it never came to market.
Ah, well, that's why I have to do a Google search every time.
Well, you don't think the Koch brothers are going to make it easy for you to hate on them, do you?
Yeah, well, I guess not. But you know, I want to make one comment about apathetic voters. I want to cut some slack here, because if we were truly apathetic, right, and maybe in the past there have been incidences of this, but if we were truly apathetic, would people be working so hard to make it difficult to vote? I don't think so. I think that all this right to vote nonsense that's going on now, making it requiring photo ID, requiring all these hoops to jump through in order to vote, is indicative of the fact that we indeed are not apathetic. They just drive us away. Or so many people are driven away by all the hoops they have to jump through. And so I would see the rhetoric, you know, the control of the narrative saying people are apathetic as a way for people to accept their fate. But indeed, if we weren't voting, they wouldn't be doing all these laws to get in our way.
Well, it's just more and more control is what they want. And it's so sad, too, to see how these companies now, I've heard it through people that have jobs. I'm a senior citizen. I'm not in that system right now. I'm an entrepreneur, a home-based business. But these companies are now saying, you better be grateful that you have a job. And they just want to keep people here. And I love what Yahoo did, the CEO woman, calling all those home-based people, the mothers taking care of their kids in business, probably doing a much better job than a lot of them in companies. So now she's bringing them back into the company physically. And what is she really doing? She's pushing everything back to the Middle Ages, because these people are going to be disgruntled, spending extra money for gas back and forth now. Maybe she'll have a few M&Ms treat for them, but now you're going to have the bosses all there too. They're just going to be bullying them in the corporate headquarters. So at the end of the day, they're going to come home, all tuck it out, and they probably would have given 120% more than what they're going to get. They're probably going to get half of what they expected when they bring them in there physically. And instead of controlling, why don't companies empower employees, customers, and beyond? That's all possible with technologies today, too.
Oh, absolutely. I've been working out of my house for 18 years. I can't imagine what life would be like if I had to go back into an office. But I've still been very successful at what I do and helped my company reach its goals. So, you know, I don't know. If you keep the demand or if you keep the supply high of labor, especially skilled labor, then obviously you're going to be able to keep wages low. And that's the sad fact, is that that's how the guys running the corporations or the gals, don't want to be sexist, that's how the people running these corporations think. It's like, I don't have to pay higher salaries, and I can hire three people to do any one job, so, you know, I'll lowball it and somebody will be desperate enough, which is how we've come to the place where we have 8% unemployment still, but we have 21% underemployment. So we've got these other 13% of Americans who are working, who have just taken whatever jobs they can, some multiple jobs, just to keep roof over their heads and food on their table. And in the meantime, where is the relief, Washington? They're talking about taking more money out of the class, out of the middle class's hands with this silliness of the sequester and the austerity and all this silliness. I don't understand. Okay, let me bring it down. All right, if you're part of the 40, I'm going to call it 45%, right? 40, yeah, maybe 43%, right? So 47, almost 48% of the people voted for Romney and would be in favor of everything I just said, would think they were great ideas. The rest of us think it's crazy, okay? But I get how the 3 or 4% of the very wealthy say, hey, yeah, let's do that. Let's get behind Romney and those ideas. What are those other 42% thinking, Janine? The ones who are still voting for people who want to take more money out of their hands, who don't want the government to help them get a job, who don't want to help. what are they thinking? How are they making that choice? How are they pulling that lever?
Well, I think this is another example of the concept that behind gerrymandering. It's like if you draw circles, funny shaped circles around bodies of neighborhoods and, you know, people, geographic groups, and if you have qualified that group in terms of certain criteria, and let's say that, you know, the Republicans in this case do more of this, but the Democrats have been known to do it too, they find a way to get themselves supported regardless of what they say and regardless of what they do. Because there's some, because there's, what's the word? It's like a part of a herd identity or something so strong that it says, you know, I'm pulling the R level lever, I'm pulling the D lever, you know, I'm going to be, you know, I was born a Democrat, I'm going to die a Democrat, I'm, you know, whatever. And I, so it's the same thing, I think, when people end up voting against their own self-interest. I think it's a function of having too much shallow information, you know, like the talking points and the code words and the, you know, the bumper sticker logic that flies through not only the mainstream media, but also, you know, I mean, talk radio and all these other places. We have to watch this ourselves, you know. But the whole notion that, I mean, there's not a phrase that isn't focus grouped. You know, there isn't a concept that hasn't succeeded multiple focus panels. It's such a science. Marketing is such a science. It's not an art anymore. And I've said this before, but, you know, back in the 60s, yes, I'm giving away my age, that we were worried that people were going to put stuff in the water and this thing in the water was going to control us. It was like mind control. And now they don't have to put it in the water. It comes over the TV. It comes over the radio. It comes in print media. It's on the Internet. And it's targeted in such a way that the vulnerable, the susceptible, their target market, very clearly described. Each target market receives specific, well-honed messages. And so how does one see, honestly, how does one see beyond the reinforcement of everything you hold valuable in your life and being assured that all the things that are valuable in your life will be maintained or improved if, you know, dot, dot, dot. I mean,
okay.
It's crazy making. I spend my entire life now trying to see past that, no matter who says it.
So I hear and agree with everything you just said. But here's the question then that's begged is, do we give up on trying to actually reason with people and get them to take off the marketing glasses and see reality for what it is? And is the only way to fight back then is just to do it and do it better? Because
no,
if you do, that you play, they're the ones with all the money. You can't out-market them.
Yes, you can. That's where I come in. You can exactly out-market them. And I'm just rolling out some passive income strategies, and I'll interject this too. In 2011, I had an occasion to have a telephone conversation with a former CEO of a major oil company, and I threw something out in the conversation just to see what his response might be. I said, there's no loyalty in these big multinational corporations anymore. You're going to get a middle manager at his workstation. You think he's doing a work for the company. He's going to be brokering business opportunities to enrich himself, his family, and friends. The CEO surprised me. He said, it's already happening. I said, good, because unless these companies don't do the right thing by their employees, their customers, and beyond, they're going to fall apart. Now, here's what you do. That's the company of the future, the way I see it, is not just providing an excellent product and service. They're going to make or break themselves by, in addition, having to provide education, opportunities, and incentives for their employees, their customers, and beyond. And I have those solutions available for people to do that, to empower themselves. My last name has global recognition in the food service field. I'm just rolling out a passive income strategy initially geared toward restaurants that has no limit on the income potential. And this is all based on these video products that I mentioned, too. So there are ways. It's just that people aren't looking at them because they stay in the old paradigm. You create a new paradigm and do it with transparency and truth and force people to, if they're not going to do that, these crooked people in the local communities and beyond are not going to be around long. And if we get to the point where it gets chaotic, do what they did in Iceland. That was beautiful. They're a way show for the world. Put all the banksters in jail, collapse the economy, start over. They're doing great.
Well, that kind of a fail-safe idea has been proffered by many people as that's what should have happened in 2008. We should have let the banks fail. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I don't know. I don't think that was necessarily the right solution for us, but bailing them out and making them whole and giving them trillions of dollars of low-interest loans and paying their executives who caused the crash their own bonuses, yeah, I think we probably went a little bit the wrong way there. But it's been great talking to you. I don't know if you have any closing thoughts for us.
No, only that you can Google that interview and anybody's welcome to call me. I don't use email as a global visionary. It takes away from my creativity to play with a keyboard all day, but I'm totally information-oriented. My partner's true American hero, a former Special Ops Green Beret who did the suicide missions over in Vietnam. He's a Mensa with three doctorates, a doctorate in psychology. He's a psychologist for over 40 years, also has a doctorate in religion, a doctorate in theology. He's an expert in the law of attraction, former law enforcement. His father was a New York federal judge. So very
okay.
Good.
All right. We're all about promoting to a certain point. But,
all right.
But we did put your name up on the chat, and we allowed people to go get it. And, again, I appreciate very much you calling in. Janine, did Jack go in and out of the queue? I can't tell.
I think I'll flip back there. I think he put down his hand and raised it again.
Oh, okay. Well, let's welcome Jack back into the mix. Jack, did you have something additional for us?
I hope there are more people.
Well, you are more people, Jack. Nobody's more important than you. Come on.
Okay. Let me say this. Okay, we think now, right now. Okay, I want everybody to listen to. There are very few commentators that make any sense. You're talking about the mass media, what Sarah Palin called the lame street media. Okay, it's very few that make any sense. They blah, 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 and they don't... they don't say anything, really. I'd say Fareed Zakaria, listen to CNN at noon Central Time on Sunday. Now listen to him and it'll make sense. Anything that has to do with foreign policy and domestic policy, for that matter.
Jack, you and I are going to do wonderful things together in our new party, because I have always thought that I think he's the most intelligent news person around. He knows more about – he's actually forgotten, I think, more about what goes on in the Middle East and the way the Middle East works than anybody else knows. And he is absolutely – would be my first choice for Secretary of State when I take the White House. I could not agree with you more. I think he's totally brilliant. I don't know. Are you a fan, Janine?
Absolutely. He's on my TiVo. And one of the things I think that is brilliant about a man like him is that he has a very American perspective of the entire world. So, he is knowledgeable, as you said, about international affairs. But he can bring it right home to... what it is that people here are concerned about. and adds context without taking away our own need to think about, you know, to see worldviews from where we sit. So I think he's brilliant. I think it's really good. It's a great idea, Jack.
Yeah, absolutely.
Also,
and
I want to say this. He's got the idea about an infrastructure bank. I think that should be the first priority, more so than worrying about the debt and all that stuff, because that'll pay the debt off. Because you'll have state and local government involved. Excuse me, and you'll have mostly private capital that would finance a lot of that stuff. So you can get involved with Gates or Gates Foundation or the Warren Buffett or a few guys like that, right? And Blumenthal in New York would be a great source. And I think we got Blumenthal on Obama's side. I'm not wholly sold on Obama either, for that matter.
Well, I agree with you. Jack, we do have one other caller that just jumped into the queue. If it's okay with you, I will...
Fine. I want to hear some more opinions.
All right. Thanks, Jack. And Janine, real quickly, going back to Fareed Zakaria, as if I didn't think the guy walked on water, and I don't know how many people follow him close enough to realize this happened, but about 4 or 5 months ago, he was actually banned for I think it was either 30 or 60 days from publishing in Newsweek, because unbeknownst to him, somebody pointed out that he had plagiarized from somebody else in an article. So he had made somebody, you know, put statements out there that made it look like they were his. He had not properly footnoted them or given the original author credit. And he came out and he said, yeah, wow, I am so sorry. I'm such an idiot. I did this. I take my punishment and I deserve it. And this is exactly what should happen. And I thank my employers for letting me do this, and I'll see you in 30 or 60 days. And I'm like, now how many people have that kind of integrity these days, especially in the media?
Well, right. I mean, he just reeks of integrity, and that's why I appreciate his economic analysis. You know, coming back to transpartisan. I mean, does transpartisan really mean above, like transcending parties? Because if it does, he's that kind of guy, you know, who actually is like above the fray of it at all and really looks for what are the facts here, what is the history here, what is the context for this, now what makes sense here, and puts things together like that. And I think it's really important for us to recognize personally, I have to do this for myself. I have this little self-doubting do loop that always says, why do you think you know that? Go, you know, reconfirm for yourself that you know that, because it's there's just such a mire of misinformation, a mire of half truths, a mire of different little tricks that people play to flip a logical conversation into one that's actually, you know, like going for the clothes. You know what I'm saying? And so it's refreshing to be around a guy like that, and it's refreshing to be in the company of people like that, which is, of course, why I became a member of the Coffee Party. I think Coffee Party saved my life, because I think I was going to blow a gasket. Now, I needed the company of other people who are willing to question themselves, not just each other, and yep. And then to do the homework it takes to sort of suss through that and get down to the heart of the matter. What do I think about this? What is it that we're up against? And by the way, if I can add this really quickly, I found this interesting definition of transpartisan economics, which is what we try to keep getting back to here. And it is from the Transpartisan Alliance. And it's there was a session of a seminar that that sort of began with a definition and went from there. The definition was this: we seek an honest, above board, participatory economic system valuing community in the creation of money, land value, and tax policy to serve our individual and common needs, creating income security for all, and not passing down debt and loss to the final consumer or future inhabitant.
That's brilliant. I love that. And, you know, I think within that, in 609, we are definitely coming right to you soon. I think within that is almost the promise of – it's the great promise of America, as well as the thing that we struggle with so much that makes our politics, I think, what it is, which is what they said for our own personal good and for the common good. And
yes.
It's that tightrope that our founders laid out for us, and they tied one side up on one side of Niagara Falls and the other side over the other side of Niagara Falls, and they said, this is what we're doing. This is our goal. You fall that way too much, that's not good. You lean that way too much, that's not good. We are going to walk this tightrope between the common good and individuals' good. And I think that's where we struggle. I fear that we've fallen into this pendulum of 20-year, 30-year swings where it's way too much to one side and way too much to the other side. But it's being now fought without our say. And it's like we're just being dragged along for the ride.
Right.
But since Coffee Party saved your life, and we're nearing the top of the hour, if you don't mind, and if just for everybody's sake, I didn't bother crying or whining earlier today, but I'm in the midst of a somewhat horrific cold. So Janine has been so nice to volunteer to do the public service announcement. So why don't we go ahead and do that? And then 6:09, we're coming to you right after we're done.
Oh, so by the public service announcement, I think you're talking about, I have two things to share. One is you're on Dan Aronson's Press One for Democracy now, but there are other Coffee Talk radio shows. This one, of course, if you're here or if you're podcasting later, is on at 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern time, Mondays, we're getting a taste of what that's all about tonight, and it's great. Tuesdays at 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern, conservative Michael Charney and progressive Eric Beiler have their show, The Middle Ground, and where they try to do exactly what we're hoping that could be done today with economics, which is basically say, what are the two perspectives, what are two perspectives on these issues? And then they bring in great guests. Thursdays, is Lunch with Loudon. That's my show, 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern. My co-pilot, Debbie Lynn Molyneux, and I try to bring some sensibility to some of our current conversations. And right now I am a pit bull for getting the money out of politics. Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, Egberto Willis does Politics Done Right. It's an open forum. Callers get to talk about anything they want to, and he may have a topic, but that doesn't matter. So there's lots of chances for everybody to listen live or stream later at Coffee Talk Radio. The second thing I want to share is our reminder, as always, that Coffee Party USA is a grassroots organization, like no kidding, funded totally by our membership. Citizens United has not benefited Coffee Party USA, I promise. If you like the show or anything else you see Coffee Party do, become a member. And you do that by going to www.coffeepartyusa.com, click on Join the Movement, click on Become a Member. You can also go there, I believe, and renew your membership. You can do a one-time annual membership, or you can do a sustaining membership like I do, where you get a little bit, you pay a little bit, contribute a little bit every month. So membership is everything. We have many members and followers, but it's only the membership that we contact when the board of directors or other decision makers are asking what's next or what's up for Coffee Party USA. So thanks. And there you have it.
Thank you, Janine. My, I thank you. My throat thanks you. And I'll tell you, if Janine Loudon, if somebody is sharp, as Janine Loudon said that the coffee party saved her life, then there has to be some good stuff going on here, because I've known Janine for, well, listening to her for all this time, for about a year-ish, and I got to know her personally a little bit, and she would not be here if this wasn't something that was important and if we weren't doing good work. So please do join if you like what you hear. Feel free to donate at any time. And right now, as promised, I'm going to bring in area code 609, and I'm going to go out on a limb because I'm feeling lucky tonight, and I'm going to guess that this is Joe. I'm just going to guess. Joe, your mic is about to be open.
No, this is Blake.
Ah, Blake, I'm sorry. All we see at Blog Talk here are the numbers that come up, so we kind of see the same numbers every once in a while, and we guess. So, my bad. How you doing, Blake, and thanks for calling.
Oh, I'm fine. I kind of came in the middle of the conversation, so I'm not sure what you're talking about. If I can get the Cliff Note version of what the topic is.
Absolutely, Blake. Are you familiar with transpartisanship? The concept of transpartisanship as the coffee party defines it?
Kind of.
Okay. The idea is to let everybody's voice be heard. Everybody comes to the conversation. No idea is untenable. We only ask that you're civil and you're fact-based, but we want those ideas, and then if we get all of the voices to the table, we will find common ground, and we will find solutions that will benefit, if not all of us, the great majority. So that's transpartisanship, and that's really what the coffee party is behind. So we welcome all voices and all opinions, and so what we're trying to figure out is this. It's easy to do at the local level, right? Because you live in a neighborhood where people have all different types of opinions and beliefs politically, but their kids all go to the same schools. So when it comes to the question, do we want our kids to have a good school, everybody says, yeah, we want kids to have great schools. They all agree all of a sudden, right? It's when everybody has the same stake in the game, then all of a sudden we find our common ground. Can we push that to the national level, to things like getting the middle class back to work, getting money out of politics and all of the other issues, gun control, all the other issues in hand? Can we push that mentality upwards to people that aren't across the street from us but are across the country from us? What do you think?
You got a difficult job there.
No doubt.
Okay. I'm not sure if I have anything else to add besides what I have heard before.
Anything? Did you have something else you wanted to chat about?
I just called in to say, just wanted to call in. Say hello, but because I remember talking, I think I vaguely remember talking about transpartisan last week. But
it does tend to creep into most of our conversations, yeah, since it is one of the three cornerstone principles of coffee party. I'll tell you what, if you want, I can put you back on mute, and then you can push one, and then if you think of something you wanted to add, you can hit one again, and it'll show me that you've raised your hand again.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay. Well, Blake, as always, we appreciate you calling in, and like I said, if you'll just go ahead and hit one, your hand will go down, and then if you hit one again later when you wish to participate, we'll bring you in. So just so that everybody knows, there's a little bit change of schedule because I am actually going to be basically hanging up the phone here for tonight's show and running off to the airport. So as normally I know we go till 12, I guess it's midnight on the East Coast for all you your late night enthusiasts on the East Coast and 9 p.m. here on the Pacific time, but we'll be cutting off here at 8:30. Pacific time tonight, 11:30 Eastern time. So not that I'm making any threats, but if you want to jump in, I see there's a bunch of people on the on the call that don't have their hands up. But if you want to say anything, just call in 646-929-2495 and press 1 for democracy. Janine, anything fun happening in the chats?
Yeah, there's a little bit going on here about... So first of all, there were posts of sending folks to see what Fareed Zakaria had done. And some people think that that was brilliant, and others think that that was a showboating, I think is the nice word I could use for it. And then there's comments about the common good. What the quote I just read that was from the Transpartisan Alliance Economic Summit, where I gave the definition of transpartisan economics, included tax policy to serve our individual and common needs. And that seems to have inflamed a few people in chat. But I'm afraid that it's also one of those interesting kind of code words. It's like a that causes a sort of pretty standardized reaction. The truth is, since the beginning days of this country, we have made choices about what we would do individually and what we would do collectively. And the whole notion of solving problems in the commons is older than the country. It predates the Constitution. It predates the Declaration of Independence. And so it's always interesting to me how people can be black and white about what that means. But it's really it's become some kind of philosophical standoff point. And I don't know any country in the world that we would call civilized that doesn't in some way provide where that government does not solve some problems in the commons. And so I never know how extremely people mean things when they say that. So I'll leave that one up, and I'm sure chat will respond to me. But I'm also getting schooled on the language of the Constitution, but the term to solve a problem in the commons is an authentic term. And General Leffler is also a very good term. Here's the question I have, though. Here's the question. What is being violated if people who are elected to represent us, who are, as you know, Dan, I call them our surrogates, what is not served by those people actually talking to each other instead of just about each other, those people actually hammering out solutions and working, working in a system of politics and governance that was designed early on and has certainly morphed as time goes by. I mean, obviously, we didn't have the internet. And so today, there's actually people who are proposing that the House of Representatives be as large as it should be. It outgrew its building, it looked prohibitive, and so we no longer have the kind of representation that was originally designed for us. But you could have 1,000 representatives in the House if they met virtually.
And then I would actually semi-jokingly say this, Janine, for as many times as I've ever watched the live sessions in the House, I believe you could have a rotating 500 or 435 people, and you could have different people in there daily, and as many people actually ever show up.
Right, right. I mean, I have to go drag them in for a vote. And so,
I mean, you could do hoteling. That's very popular, right?
Right. And so, all I'm saying is, the only reason I bring that example up is this: obviously, we're not going to execute the way we did 200 years ago. We're not going to execute this charge we call the governance of this republic's democracy. It is not going to be the same. That does not mean that in order to be true to the framers, you have to go back to carrying a musket. You know, it's just not smart. It's not good logic, and it's not a good argument. So I find it very interesting that people will use phrases to denigrate concepts. And when people use little bits of a sentence to denigrate the content of a paragraph, all they're doing is saying, I didn't want to listen anyway. I found my out. You're done. Am I being too extreme here? I mean, and this is one of the reasons that coffee parties saved my life, is because I was out there with the best of them, doing verbal battle, doing whatever, and realizing that, A, all I did was give myself an ulcer, but B, there was no power in this positionality. There was no power in sort of taking my stand and doing combat from there. The power was in the common conversation. The power is in the way we speak and listen. The power is in our getting that we are all more alike than we are different, that our differences are non-fatal errors in most cases. And, you know, there's my business background speaking. But a non-fatal error is, okay, maybe this isn't perfect, but it doesn't matter that it isn't perfect. What matters is that it moves you forward. And so, you know, when NASA was my client, we talked a lot about fatal errors and non-fatal errors. You know, when I was building a new research laboratory, you know, absolute attention to the things that could not fail. You know, and so that's why when I see people treating the economy like our, what's the word, fiscal reality, as though it were this, had the same level of importance as, you know, what kind of lapel pin people should wear in Congress, I'm just flabbergasted. You know, it is not the same. You know, it only took a decade of war to trash us. A decade of war trashed us, and we will not recover for another 10 years minimum. You know, and anybody with skin in the game knows that. And it's all the people who are drowning, going for a piece of the game like it was a piece of wreckage.
Well,
you know,
and
who
that's
have
the,
these amazing
yeah.
conversations, but they don't mean anything.
Well, that, you know, that's something that you know, Joseph Stiglitz points out in his book, The Price of Inequalities. He said Washington is now full of people who care more about personal outcomes than social outcomes, and that's. You know, that is the reality. And you know, I don't know this, so that's just for fun, since we don't have any callers ready to jump on here and tell us why we're wrong. what do you know what the total federal budget is in round figures?
Oh, say it again?
Do you know what the total federal government's budget is in round figures?
I don't, but I could find it for you in just a second.
Okay.
So the federal budget, like a single year, like this year?
Yeah.
Federal budget for 2013 return, and we'll get an answer here. And, of course, Wikipedia is the first one that comes up, so we'll just hit that one really quickly.
Yeah. That's by the way, that reminds me of something else, too. That's very interesting.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say the whole Wikipedia thing. Wikipedia works because it's grassroots, and because there's a very loose, but yet strict guideline of what you're allowed to say, and how you're allowed to say it. Like, you're not allowed to come up and say that guy's wrong. You're allowed to put out what you think is true. They put out what they think is true. That everybody they can argue about it. They can figure out. They can the board can decide which one it is. Otherwise, they just both stand out there, and. I'm like, wait, why can't we do that with government? Shouldn't we have? I think we should have wiki government.
Right. It's interesting too, because the Wikipedia is totally jammed up with trying to figure out what the heck the sequester means. So, what is the budget? And so I can't even give you a number from this. Oh, the total revenue, total requested expenditures, $3.803 trillion requested expenditures.
All right. Well, let's start. Okay. Well, let's start with there, because that's actually the important one. So 3.803. Okay. So three. If you take 3.803, and that's trillion, right?
Yes. Yeah, 3.23.
Okay, and we'll divide that by 435, the number of members of the House of Representatives who have the sole purview of spending that money, right?
Yeah.
They're the only ones that can bring a spending bill to law.
Right.
Right? So each one of those people now, theoretically, is controlling $873 billion. Now you want to know why there's a problem with government in Washington?
Yes.
When the day you set foot in Washington as a member of the House of Reps, you control $8.37 billion, and people want that money. And
Right. They're
going to do everything they can to get it. And you're either going to have to be a bastion of altruism and untouchableness, or you're going to succumb to the game.
Oh, right.
$873 billion per member of the House of Reps. Ouch, that's a huge number.
There you go. especially since rural areas are overrepresented and urban areas are underrepresented because we stopped adding, to the size of that body. But I think this is interesting because in my business life, I was first with middle management in a multinational, then middle management in another multinational, And then I became a refugee from multinational for my own company, and then, had 40 employees, blah, blah. But the thing is, the perspective of being a cog in that wheel is really, it's not sustainability like we think it's sustainability now. It's like survival. How do I continue to make this money and make more? How do I continue? So whether you need that program anymore, whether you need that project anymore, whether you need that contract anymore, whether the contractor's really serving a need or not, there's this huge momentum to keep that happening. And so I always kind of giggle when people talk about the food stamp problem or the, free immunizations to children problem or problem, And I can tell you right now that my competitors, Halliburton, my competitors, GE, my competitors, back in the day, they wasted more in an hour than any food stamp company, or ever wasted in a year. And I'm not saying that. I'm not being rhetorical here. I was in the guts. I had the budget. Those were the people I was bidding against. And, it is crazy making to me to think that business is not culpable in this deficit and in our debt. And I hope people understand the difference. Deficit is a budget word. It is not a real word. It's a reality word. It's a budget word. And debt is real. Debt is what actually happens. Deficit tells you debt might come, but it's not a guarantee that debt will come. And because the other piece that's missing in a budget conversation is revenue, why aren't we talking revenue, expenses? Like, what is our mission as a country? What is our objective? What is the lifestyle that we expect in America? What is the idea that the poorest children will go without immunizations is a public health nightmare. It's a public health nightmare, not just because those kids are going to get sick, but because other people's kids are going to get sick because those kids were sick. And it's, I guess to wrap this up, I just want to say it takes a very adult conversation to solve a complex problem. And we are prevented from having adult conversations about economics or anything else in the core mission of this country when we reduce ourselves to little, throwing little wads of paper at each other, which are really, exchanging talking points or having our already always response to you say this and I'm going to say that. There's no communication there. There's no problem solving there. We are hitting the wall with problems that are, they are fatal errors to not solve them. And we're treating them the same as whether or not women should have penetrating ultrasounds for, you know, in order to terminate a pregnancy. It is just amazing to me that we can in any way bring these things together into the same breath and actually think we're talking anything but nonsense.
I agree with you. And, you know, I love listening to you go. I was like, I just want to go, you go, girl.
Sorry.
The only problem is I have to, like, take lots of notes because I was like, wait, I want to respond to that. I want to respond to that. I want to respond to that. So since we are running down on time here, I wanted to respond to something. You know, you said something that actually, when I was writing the post for the show, I actually had almost a dual theme going. One of the themes I didn't end up putting in there that really was the primary driver was, how can we expect people in Washington to be working for the betterment of the common good and towards the goals that will help the people when they're not, that's not even part of the conversation. One guy says, less government, less spending, let the private sector do it. The other guy says, no, more taxes, close the loopholes, and then we'll do some kind of government spending that'll stimulate the economy. And I think the president kept saying, I think in his acceptance speech, we'll make 1,000 jobs in clean energy. And I just went, ugh, 1,000 jobs, really? Come on. We've got millions and millions of people out of work. We need more than 1,000. We need plans on a grandiose scale. We are so messed up in this country, the equality gap. From an opportunity standpoint, from an income standpoint, is growing daily. It's getting worse and worse all the time, and nobody in Washington is talking about it. Who in Washington is talking about, here's my plan for getting the middle class back to work, and not back to work in low-paying jobs, which is what has happened over the 4 years since the crash, but putting them back in the middle-class jobs. Who's put that plan forward? Who's even talking about it?
Well, actually, lots of people talk about this. You know, I mean, my entire congressional delegation talks about this. Oregon's been in recession for over 10 years. And so it's like, we talk about this. The problem is that we found these snarky ways to not cooperate, therefore not get anything done about it. You know, we found, you know, snarky ways to create loopholes. We found snarky ways to do all kinds of mischief. And then we come up with the little explanations that supposedly make sense, those focus panel juried explanations that will sell, you know? I mean, like, my favorite one is, why should the top 1% or whatever pay some huge percentage of the taxes? Let's say it's 43 or 45% of the taxes. Really? Well, because you control 80% of the wealth.
call on me. I just saw this one. In the last 30 years, the top 1% has amassed 50% greater wealth, while the other 99% has gained a total of half of 1%. The government rigged it in your favor. It's called trickle-down economics. They lowered your taxes, they lowered your capital gains rates, they gave you all the breaks so that you could get rich, but you were supposed to share, you haven't shared. Isn't it time that the rest of us stepped in and say, excuse me? I mean, to me, it's a breach of contract. We had a contract. We did our part, we suffered, and you have it good, but you haven't, now do your part. I mean, it'd be like paying somebody to build you a mansion, and they went ahead, took the money, built themselves a mansion, and then when you knocked on their door and said, excuse me, where's mine? They went, what are you talking about?
Exactly.
I mean, to me, it's that simple. I just don't know why it's not that – I don't know why everybody doesn't see it that way. And I don't do – I do okay. I do okay financially. I'm not poor. I do okay. It's just – to me, it's a matter of – of what's right. It's morality at this point. Those people are being immoral. And I'm not saying all rich people are, because we know guys like Will Rice and the patriotic millionaires who have been calling for higher taxes and saying, yeah, we need to pay our fair share. So I don't want to make this into a class warfare either. But let's face it, it's pretty easy to look at the 30-year runs that these corporations have had of quarter after quarter after quarter of record profits while unemployment stays stagnant, while the lower classes make less money and lose all their wealth was in their houses because the rich people, the bankers said, hey, you could take loans against your houses and have vacations and have all this good stuff. And like I said, to me, I just get outraged because to me, it's just this immorality that exudes from a portion of the top that just it makes me so mad. And it's like the only way that we can ever correct this is through the government.
Right. I mean, this ship of state is massive, and it has. It has a constitution. It has all kinds of mores, and it has official positions about what's right and what's wrong. It has implied positions about what is right and what is wrong. But one of the things that we all presume is its endurance. You know, that this republic will endure, that this republic's democracy will endure, and that this republic's economy will endure. And, you know, globalization has put all ships of state in jeopardy because it has transcended the national and it's become international, multinational, and it's like it hopscotches for opportunity. And so there's no promise. You know, we promise a military that will defend us. We promise water systems that will deliver water to factories. We promise all kinds of things, but we get no promises back anymore. Or the kinds of promises we get back are mediocre in comparison to the cost of the nation keeping its promises to its citizens. And so it's miraculous to me that we don't respect the sanctity of the union. We don't respect sanctity of a government as the tool of the people to exercise its collective will on, you know, that as it governs our day-to-day lives, as it governs our relationships to other governments, as it governs, what's the ultimate word, you know, like...
Well, I believe the document says to ensure justice first. That's the first one, justice, peace... Justice, to ensure justice, to serve up justice. Justice is not being served. And here's if you want to get all 1984-ish about it, let's project out 15 years from now if this does not change. What you have now is you have basically what is, economically speaking, akin to a Saudi or any one of the Middle Eastern dictatorships where all of the money now is on the top. Well, the Arab Spring, it will happen here. I mean, this was the place we kind of invented that stuff. And what makes those people think that if it keeps on going like this, that there's not going to be a real revolutionary movement?
Oh, well, I think people want that real revolution. I think that they're – listen, I've been a member of the Southern Poverty Law Center for, you know, since the 80s. And I read the reports that they do and the outcome of the cases they prosecute. And I'll tell you, there are more and more people out there who are so committed to civil war, it's not funny. And they want it, but they want it for very... Again, this is a market strategy. It is not beneficial to anyone who... It's like we can shoot each other, but we can't talk to each other. How bizarre is that? That's actually a conversation we would entertain. Who made that possible?
Yeah,
it's not some kid on food stamps. You know, it's just not. You know, you're kidding yourself if you think that.
Yep. Well, Janine, I really, really, very much appreciate you volunteering to hop on board and save my voice. Love your passion that you bring to the show. Love your wisdom. Born of only a few years, and it's always great to have you by my side. This is Dan Aronson. You've been listening to Press One for Democracy. We're on each Monday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And I hope very much that you will all come back and join us. Thank you, Jack. Thank you, Hugh. Thank you for all of our callers. Blake, come back next time and help us out. And as always, remember, go ahead, Janine.
Well, coffee party on.
There you go. Have a good night, everyone.